It's Tuesday, February 23rd. We never thought it would get so bad, and then it got so much worse. We start here.
They had him in a casket, and in the casket, he was in a bag.
It was unthinkable a year ago, but the American death toll has now surpassed 500,000.
He deserved a lot more.
Today, we'll take a look at how devastating just one of those deaths can be. We've heard stories about Capitol Police officers on January 6th, but we haven't heard them in their own words until now.
Listen, you effing...
So the crowd joined
everybody,
in
everybody. Everybody joined in with him.
In an ABC News exclusive, one officer on the battle lines describes the violence and hatred. And when people do get back on airplanes, which ones will be allowed to fly?
Airplanes fly better and break less often when they're flown more.
Why one jaw-dropping video has led to a worldwide scramble. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Sometimes I think about the generation that we call America's greatest generation. Over the course of 5 years in their lives, World War II shaped every single household. It affected your workplace. It affected your town's economy, your government, your family's mood, their parenting, your aspirations. It changed everything. At the center of all that was more than 400,000 Americans dying. 400,000 over 5 years of war. That sacrifice and our response to it shaped us all for generations.
Bells tolling at the Washington National Cathedral, and as we have done for the past year, the awful toll again tonight.
As we acknowledge the scale of this mass death in America, we remember each person and the life they lived.
In the course of 1 year, our country has now lost 500,000 people to COVID-19. That is the tally from Johns Hopkins University. So if you think we all go back to normal after all this, here's your headline. The world will never be the same. Lives will never be the same.
As a nation, we can't accept such a cruel fate. While we've been fighting this pandemic for so long, we have to resist becoming numb to the sorrow.
Now, there are lots of legitimate questions about what we do now and how we shape the rest of this pandemic.
We've done worse than most any other country, and we're a highly developed, rich country.
Yesterday, Dr. Anthony Fauci told ABC News that any ideas of herd immunity, they're going to come later rather than sooner.
We've got to be really careful and not just say, okay, we're finished now, we're through it. We have variants out there that could actually set us back.
In the meantime, he said he's impressed by vaccinations, but children might not get them until later this year, maybe even next year. Masks will still be part of your life because of that, to stop the spread to families who have not been vaccinated yet, or to keep the virus from mutating. But he did reflect on the sheer amount of death in this country.
You know, it's so tough to just go back and try and, you know, do a metaphorical autopsy on how things went. It was just bad. It is bad now.
For every death, one study says, there are up to 9 people left behind grieving. In fact, our guest today is one of 9 siblings who've seen the tragedy of this pandemic up close. We're going to talk to her today. Beatrice Ramirez is from Passaic, New Jersey. And Beatrice, do all 9 of you live together?
I live with 5 of my siblings. No, 4 of my siblings. The other 4 live on their own. Juan is 11. He's going to turn 12 soon in May. And he's the youngest. Because I'm in college, so just me and under. So just the 4 of us are in school.
Right. I know some of them are doing their Zoom classes as we're speaking to each other. So I'm glad you could make the time with us. Can you just tell me what the last year of your life has been like?
Well, for us as a family, it's been very tragic. Even before the whole pandemic, we were already, you know, suffering a loss from our mother. In November, she passed away from a heart attack in Mexico. So she went for a couple of days. And the day she was supposed to come back, in the morning, she had a heart attack. And she passed away over there.
Oh, wow. So you're very much grieving before this pandemic even starts then.
Yeah, at that point, yeah. Then this whole pandemic hit, nobody really knew a lot about it.
Out of the growing threat as the coronavirus continues to spread, New Jersey announcing its first presumed case.
And that's with cold and flu season here, how do you know the difference? How do you know when to call your doctor about possible coronavirus?
Sometimes the symptoms can overlap, David.
I got sick in my family first, and I was doing pretty badly. It was to a point where I couldn't breathe well. I had a lot of trouble breathing. So my dad and my family were there to help me, you know, try to get better, see how things go. And then soon we started to see that my dad started getting sick. He started having symptoms, and he was the one that got worse. He's 39. He does exercise. We didn't think it was going to hit him so hard to the point where, you know, he had to be in the hospital. But he didn't want us to call the ambulance. That was something he really, like, he was really strict about.
Why didn't he want you to call the ambulance?
He didn't want to leave us. He, that's what his, it was something that he just didn't like. He didn't want to leave us alone.
Oh, and especially since he was the you know, the only parent in the house.
Yeah.
Wow.
But we saw that he was only getting worse. We felt like if we weren't doing anything besides just seeing him get worse, we had to do something. So I ended up calling the ambulance, and they took him to the hospital. Then they said that he was getting bad, so they took him to the ICU, where he got sedated. Mm. The day before he passed away, they said he was doing great, like he was doing a lot better, that he was responding to, you know, what they were giving him, that he seemed like he was going to make it. Then the next day is when, you know, we got the news that he passed away.
Wow. Did you know that you might lose him? Was that a possibility in your mind?
Even before he went to the hospital, we were already afraid of that.
Really?
We were afraid that we weren't going to see him anymore. Like, he wasn't going to make it. At a point, he even took me in by myself, and he told me, he's like, just be ready. Be ready for whatever comes. Because I think he felt it. He was fighting, but he wasn't doing a lot. So he took me into the room, and he told me to be prepared for the worst. That if anything were to happen, I have to be ready. I was his oldest daughter, and he kind of gave me the responsibility to take care of my siblings.
Oh, because your mother had other kids, but you're his oldest daughter.
His oldest daughter, yes.
How old are you right now?
I'm 19.
So you were 18 then, right? And I know you got some older, you know, half-brothers and sisters to take care of your younger siblings, but I'm just wondering, for an 18-year-old, what is that like?
I was scared. Even if being 18, you know, as a Hispanic family, you're not able to really grow up in a sense. My dad was always very protective of us. He didn't let me work because he wanted me to stay in school. It was education first. Mm. And he said that he was going to maintain everything, that I didn't have a necessity to work because we weren't in need of money. So when both of them were just gone, because it was in such a short span of time that they were just not here anymore. So it kind of took up that I had to grow up. Like, I had to do better. I had to start working. I had to do more for myself now more than ever, and for my siblings as well.
And I think it's easy to forget, Beatrice, that this whole time you're not able to see him in person, right? He's been sedated, so you haven't even been able to speak. Like, when do you finally get to see him?
In that regard, we had paid for a funeral. I thought that it was going to be not the same it was for my mom, because not a lot of people can go there. But at least to have a viewing, to have him in the casket, at least dressed nicely or something done for him. But when we went to the funeral home, they had him in a casket. And in the casket, he was in a bag.
Wait, his body was in a bag?
Yeah. So he wasn't dressed. He wasn't anything. He was just in a bag. Like, it was... They gave us the option to go up and still see him if we wanted to. Mm. They didn't know what, like, if his... Because he was contacted with COVID, then they didn't know if his body still had that kind of contagious. So they had him in a bag. When we had the option to go up and go see him, and we did, or at least, yeah, I think we all did. But it wasn't at all what we wanted it to be. Like, for us, he deserved a lot more than to be in the hospital by himself, than to be wrapped in a bag instead of in his clothes, in a casket. It wasn't, like, he just didn't deserve, it didn't deserve to be that way for him. All the siblings that now live by themselves, they were living with us in our apartment. So we were all close family. And even with my dad there, we were still together. We were still managing to pay rent there. We were still managing to live where we were pretty much raised. Like, we spent a lot of years in that house, a lot of memories that we built in that house. So after my dad passed away, the landlord, he heard about what happened. And since none of the people that were named in the lease were living in the house anymore, he kind of just told us that we had to move out.
Really?
Yeah, we had to move out. Since only my sister, she took custody of my younger siblings as they're underage, then I also came here to live with them. And they had to, the other siblings that were living with us, they had to find an apartment, like, separate from us, because we didn't have enough space here, barely for us. And we weren't able to bring them in either. So they had to get an apartment of their own. And it was hard for them because now they're paying stuff a lot, like bills a lot more.
Right. And it makes me wonder, I guess, you know, as you have a year to reflect on this, it makes me wonder if it feels like the trajectory of your life is changing right then. Like, if all of a sudden the person that pays the rent is gone, the breadwinners are gone, you're 18, you're supposed to be going to college in a few months, right?
Yeah, it's you kind of lose that hope. In the beginning, I did, in the sense that I didn't want to continue anything. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to be in school anymore. Right. My sister, she used to work with my mom in this Panera bakery. And she used to work there and she was doing good. But being there where my mom used to be, you know, it kind of took a toll on her as well. So she ended up leaving it, even with the salary that she was gaining. It was good, but she just couldn't be there anymore. But being a big family, you know, we're there for each other. I didn't want them to feel that way. Right. So I made myself not feel that way, in a sense. They make me stronger. Every single one of my siblings make me stronger to keep on doing what I'm doing so that they also keep doing what they're doing. And that everything that my mom and my dad wanted for us is still going to be a thing. And we'll do it on behalf of them.
And you did end up going to school, it sounds like.
A Passaic County Community College.
And what are you studying?
Graphic design.
I mean, that's great to hear that you've been able to go to class. This was all unfolding for you then last April. When you hear this number now, 500,000, half a million, these months later, what goes through your mind, Beatrice? Like, are you even able to think about it?
I do. Seeing that the number has gone so high that at a point, my father just becomes one of those numbers. It's because in a range, for us, it obviously means everything. Like, it means a lot because he was our father. But in the big range of things, he was just another victim of what this virus does to a whole bunch of families.
Right.
You see things in movies. You see things. Like, I swear I've done that so many times where I see movies of people losing their parents. And, like, I would die. Like, I can't imagine my life without my parents. And here I am living exactly what I thought that I couldn't live through.
Hey, do you still have symptoms or lingering effects from COVID?
My heart, supposedly, because of how bad it got, my heart, I don't know, it gets weird. I get odd pains in my chest. I went to the doctor for it, and they said that it could be because of when I had COVID and how bad it was for me. But I do have some lingering pain in my chest due to what happened, yeah.
You have a pain in your heart. And so many families going through so much pain, and not all the same type of tragedy after you also had the loss of your mother. But it makes me think, there's nine of you, and it just reminds us how many people there are in this country right now walking around among us with these wounds, this pain in their hearts. Beatrice, I just can't begin to thank you enough for sharing your story.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Next up on Start Here, Capitol police officers have kept mostly silent about January 6th until now. The ABC News exclusive after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much I know.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
This hearing will come to order.
Yesterday, senators heard from the man that President Biden has nominated to be U.S. Attorney General, Merrick Garland. You may remember that name, because this was the guy who was nominated for a Supreme Court seat in early 2016, but a Republican Senate never gave him a hearing.
Senator, I think this was the most heinous attack on the democratic processes that I've ever seen, and one that I never expected to see in my lifetime.
And he told these senators that his first action as the nation's top prosecutor would be pursuing those who attacked Congress on January 6th. Well, on the same day, yesterday morning, ABC's Chief Justice correspondent Pierre Thomas became the first reporter to unveil an extensive on-camera interview with a member of the Capitol Police that defended the building that day. Pierre is with us right now. And Pierre, what do you think you get from this officer? Because we've heard so much about that day, and yet never from one of these officers. What has that added to your understanding of that event?
Well, Officer Dunn, it's the first time we hear from anybody from the Capitol Police about what happened inside that building.
Everybody starts out with that little kids do. I want to be a fireman. I want to be a policeman.
Right.
I wanted to be a police officer as a kid.
He's a Capitol Police officer, at least 13-year member of the force.
January 6th. Was supposed to be off that week.
Happened to be working that day and confronted the mob. And I think that he humanizes the story and takes us beyond those riveting, searing, awful images that we saw as the mob forced its way in.
I got sad. I got hurt. Even just during this interview.
He says, no, this was happening to people.
I'm getting angry now. I'm sad.
It was happening to them, his colleagues. It was happening to him. He helps us understand what a sheer horrible situation that was.
Does he give you a sense of what the preparation was like for this day? Like within Capitol Police, do they have thoughts as to why this happened the way it did?
He's speaking for himself and not for the department. I need to emphasize that. Mm-hmm. And what he will say is that day, they were not expecting an insurrection.
We just thought it was going to be a couple protesters, which is common. We have First Amendment protests at the Capitol all the time.
Well, he will say is that day that they were warned that there might be protests and there might be a need for, you know, gas masks and helmets.
So I responded over to the west side on the platform stage. And I look out and I see the crowd. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, whoa.
So what was he seeing then as this begins? Like, what were his recollections of this crowd approaching?
Complete chaos.
They're going in.
You smell nothing but pepper spray. OC canisters going off. Everybody's coughing.
Because we're getting gassed.
He saw members of the mob with bear spray. He saw members of the mob with sticks, pipes, bats.
We would throw grenades, smoke grenades at them, tear gas. They would grab it and throw it back at us.
They're beating the s*** out of
us. He saw them crashing through windows. He saw them willing to take flags and turn them into weapons to beat police with.
You have the nerve to have a Blue Lives Matter flag, but y'all kicking our ass out here with that flag.
He saw utter and complete chaos.
Stop following orders! Stop!
And a total lack of respect for law enforcement.
Just laying there on the floor.
The rotunda.
The rotunda.
The pinnacle
of the American democracy. And all this stuff is there. And I sat down with a good friend of mine. And I looked at him. I said, what the hell happened?
The intensity of his description is something I will long remember.
Well, and we've paid so much attention, rightfully so, to Officer Eugene Goodman, who we saw essentially keep Mitt Romney safe before then he goes downstairs, confronts people, leads them past the Senate chamber, so like at a very vulnerable moment. But even more broadly, for because there's so many police officers here, what was it like if you were a cop in front of these people? Like, were they talking to you? Were they coming
at you?
No,
to this crowd, the police were to be pummeled to get inside the building. Police were people to be beaten down.
According to them, they were doing it for us. They were doing us a favor. According to those terrorists, they were doing us a favor. And like I said earlier,
you're very precise. You use the word terrorist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It wasn't just a mob or a bunch of thugs, you know. They were terrorists.
Police were people to be challenged. They kept telling them that in some cases they should stop what they were doing and help them arrest members of Congress.
One officer described the trauma he experienced when the rioters seized the Capitol. He said, quote, I'm a black officer. There was a lot of racism that day.
Can we talk about race, Pierre? Because I remember during the impeachment trial, they talked about one police officer at the end of this crazy day almost crying out to be heard. Is this America? It was this powerful moment. Turns out that's the person that was Officer Dunn. Is that right?
The man we interviewed exclusively for ABC News is that man. He says that the people, many of them who were in that crowd, were straight up racist.
Outside of Steny Hoyer's office in the Capitol, it's a tribute to John Lewis.
He described how at one point there was a tribute to iconic Congressman John Lewis, and he described how the mob found a picture that accompanied that tribute and literally ripped it to shreds.
They've ripped it in half once. They picked it up and they ripped it again and again, and it was in pieces. It was deliberate. The American flag stayed up.
He described engaging the mob in a conversation.
They were saying how Joe Biden did not win the election and nobody voted for him. So I took the bait and okay, what about me? I voted for Joe Biden. Does my vote not count?
And that's when one of the members of the crowd yelled,
say, hey, this voted for Joe Biden, guys. Hey, everybody, this voted for Joe Biden. They said, you effing.
So the crowd joined
everybody,
in with
him. Everybody joined in with him.
State capitals right now have additional security.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ring of security around the Capitol now. Because you now know that's not theory,
mm-hmm.
That's real.
Absolutely. The police officer in me is comforted by that ring of security, by those barbed wire fences around it. The police officer in me loves that. Thank you. Leave it up forever. But the American in me says, we can't do this. What are we, really? Is this America? It might be.
Right, like you said, just so powerful to hear these officers in their own words from their perspective. You'll actually see more of this interview next week on a new ABC News primetime show called Soul of a Nation. Every week, it's examining the lived experience of Black Americans. Pierre, it's a great interview here. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
One last thing. You've probably seen images of a United Airlines flight leaving Denver where an engine has exploded in flame and is just disintegrating before passengers' eyes.
One of those blades that you see in the front of the engine, one of those giant, heavy titanium blades, snapped off right at the root, and then another one snapped in half.
That's ABC's aviation contributor, Colonel Stephen Ganyard.
And all that heavy metal got sucked down that engine and destroyed everything behind it, leading to this big catastrophic fire and explosion.
And all of a sudden there was just a big boom and the ring around the engine flew off.
Got a blown engine. Oh no!
Look at that piece falling down there. Look
hey, can
there.
You grab Josie?
Why?
So that she doesn't get hit by something.
911, are you calling about the airplane incident? We're getting blown up with 911 calls.
And there's the engine right there, part of it, I guess. Everybody's fine.
And when people start finding engine parts from a Boeing 777 in their backyards, which they did, they immediately start asking, is this just one plane or is this a bigger problem?
They were bracing for impact, praying with each other on a United Airlines flight overnight from Hawaii, fearing the worst.
So we do have some history here. 3 years ago, there was a United flight, same kind of airplane, same kind of engine, that threw two blades, same exact failure mechanism, on its way into Honolulu.
Yeah, a lot of passengers filmed this, the engine on the wing as the cover of the engine flew off. They heard loud banging as the plane landed.
This week, we've seen several countries, including the U.S., tell airlines they have to ground certain planes.
It's important to separate the airline from the airline manufacturer and the engine manufacturer. When an airline is buying an airplane, they often have a choice of engines. They can go to Pratt & Whitney, they can go to Europeans, they can go to General Electric, and they can put a different kind of engine.
This morning, the FAA and Japan's Civil Aviation Bureau grounding all Boeing 777s with a specific Pratt & Whitney engine.
So that's why you're seeing only about 130 of the 2,000 777s worldwide being grounded, because it just pertains to the people who bought the 777 with this kind of engine.
Colonel Ganyard, if they're looking at metal fatigue or whatever they're afraid it might be, I guess, like, I'm thinking there aren't actually that many planes in service because of the pandemic. Like, no one's flying.
Yes.
I'm wondering about later this year or next year. Like, forget just these insane pictures. How complicated is post-pandemic life about to get for the airline industry?
Yes. Important to note that this United 777 had been in service. It hadn't been pulled out of service. But I will tell you that most pilots believe that airplanes fly better and break less often when they're flown more. It's when they sit around that they tend to break. So in this case, there's going to be a real concern as we bring all these airframes and these pilots who are out of currency back on. It's going to be a real question about how's the FAA going to manage that kind of increased safety risk that we have never seen in the history of aviation.
Now, this particular engine maker, Pratt & Whitney, says it's supporting regulators in their inspections and that they will continue to make sure their engines are safe. Clearly, air travel officials are going to be even more cautious than usual, because whether you're traveling or not, we've had enough worries in 1 year. As always, if you find the show useful, if it is part of your day, if you find interviews like the one with Beatrice compelling, let us know. We really do appreciate ratings and reviews, sharing the pod with your friends. It makes a huge difference to us. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.